This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about a documentary revealing the involvement of two United States colonels in torture in Iraq.
2004, 2005 in Iraq. Tens of thousands of Iraqis are tortured. The U.S. set it up, funded it, knew about it happening, and did nothing to stop it.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, it seems that every week there's an update on the Bradley Manning case. What has happened since you last reported in on the guilty plea?
I mean, it's finally getting the attention, beginning to get the attention it deserves for a man who's a real hero for disclosing all of these government crimes, etc. But, you know, I've been going down to the trial, and you sit in the courtroom and you listen to the whole thing. And I listened and I heard it and I reported on it here. And then there was a transcript made by some of the reporters, I think, who consolidate their notes because they don't give us a transcript. They don't give us the oral testimony. They don't give us anything. So you got to sit in the room. My room, you can't put a computer in. I'm in the actual courtroom. The reporters are in a feed and they can bring their computers at least to type what the transcript is. So two things have happened regarding this transcript. And it's, as I said last time, it's incredibly moving to hear the political reasons for why he did what he did. A collateral murder video. But the first thing that happened is the government issued a transcript of the hearing finally. Now, I should say, we had already gotten a transcript first from the reporters who put it together. The Guardian had published it. And that transcript seems pretty accurate to me. It had a few holes, but not many. The government issued a transcript, and they redacted their transcript. You can't sort of believe this. I mean, they took out every name in the transcript and some other things, and yet we have every name, and I heard them in court, and there's nothing classified about that, but they took them out. And the one thing I tweeted about, at my tweet, at just left, the one thing I tweeted about, one line they took out was, we were nervous because the newly elected, and then they blank out President Barack Obama's name, was thinking about closing Guantanamo or promised to close Guantanamo. Bradley Manning is testifying why he's upset. He said, the newly elected president, and he says in court, Barack Obama, was going to close Guantanamo. And they redact the words Barack Obama. I mean, these people are out of their minds. So the first thing you get is this redacted transcript, which just shows you what Mickey Mouse people these are. And, you know, we're still not getting any documents. The whole thing is just a fraud. The whole business is secret. And then yesterday I'm sitting up in Boston and I get a link to the actual oral testimony of Bradley Manning reading his 1 hour or so statement. And it's incredible. You can actually hear Bradley Manning reading it. And it's the first time he's been able to speak to us, speak to the American public. And it's dramatic. And of course, it was leaked from somewhere. Perhaps it was leaked from the government, from someone inside. I don't know how, but it's out there. I don't know what's going to happen now or what the government's going to do about trying to restrict whatever people's access. I don't know. But we now have a transcript, and I'm recommending to every one of our listeners, and we'll link to it on our page, to link and go listen to the Bradley Manning testimony at court, because it's one of the most powerful pieces of testimony I've ever heard in a court. This testimony was released by the newly formed Freedom of the Press Foundation. The Freedom of the Press Foundation has its own interesting history. It was set up so that Press in Jeopardy could raise money. And it selects four organizations every 2 months or so, what it calls the bundle. And you can go to Freedom of the Press Foundation and give money to the organizations you choose. WikiLeaks is always one of the four because, as you know, WikiLeaks was shut off by PayPal, the banks, Chase, etc., MasterCard. So now there's a way to give money directly to WikiLeaks as well as other organizations. So I recommend going to the Freedom of the Press Foundation, but they are the people who gave us the link to the Bradley Manning testimony. Great moment, really, in history.
It was Daniel Ellsberg that founded that foundation.
He was, at least, Daniel was involved, and he's on the board. And now we'll play a short excerpt of Bradley Manning's testimony. Let's have a listen.
The fact that neither CENTCOM nor the Multinational Forces of Iraq, or MCF, MNFI, would not voluntarily release the video troubled me further. It was clear to me that the event happened because the air weapons team mistakenly identified Rose employees as a potential threat, and that the people in the bongo truck were really attempting to assist the wounded. The people in the van were not a threat, but merely good Samaritans. The most alarming aspect of the video to me, however, was the seemingly delightful bloodlust the air weapons they appeared to have. They dehumanized the individuals they were engaging and seemed to not value human life by referring to them as, quote, dead bastards, unquote, and for congratulating each other on the ability to kill in large numbers. At one point in the video, there's an individual on the ground attempting to crawl to safety. The individual is seriously wounded. Instead of calling for medical attention to the location, one of the air weapons team crew members verbally asked for the wounded person to pick up a weapon so that he can have a reason to engage. For me, this seems similar to a child torturing ants with magnifying glass. While saddened by the air weapons team's crew, crew's lack of concern about human life, I was disturbed by the response to the discovery of injured children at the scene. In the video, you can see that the bongo truck driving up to assist the wounded individual. In response, the air weapons team crew, as soon as the individuals are a threat, they repeatedly request for authorization to fire on the bongo truck, and once granted, they engage the vehicle at least six times. Shortly after the site engagement, a mechanized infantry unit arrives at the scene. Within minutes, the air weapons team crew learns that children are in the van, and despite the injuries, the crew exhibits no remorse. Instead, they downplay the significance of their actions, saying, quote, well, it's their fault for bringing their kids into a battle, unquote. The air weapons team crew members sound like they lack sympathy for the children or their parents. Later, in a particularly disturbing manner, the air weapons team crew verbalizes enjoyment at the sight of one of the ground vehicles driving over a body, or one of the bodies.
What you just heard was historic. That was an excerpt of Bradley Manning's testimony at Fort Meade, in which he took responsibility, and particularly political responsibility, for the leaks he made to WikiLeaks. Michael, here we are, roughly about the 10th anniversary, on March 20th, of the beginning of the Iraq War, an illegal war of aggression, a war that many people here opposed. There were the biggest demonstrations in the world a few days before the war, but Bush went ahead with the war in any case. Why don't we just remind our listeners a little bit of the consequences of that war? Apart from the country still being ripped apart, the number of deaths and wounded is just gigantic.
Well, that's why aggressive war is the supreme crime. That's why the United States prosecuted the Germans at the Nuremberg trial after the Second World War. The Iraq body count project estimated between 110,000 to 121,000 civilians, and it goes all the way up. The Lancet survey, Lancet is the journal of the British Medical Society, and their survey had between 601 to 654,000 people, civilians killed in the war.
Well, killed as a result really of not necessarily direct killing, but violently.
Yeah, or starvation, right. Disease. Right. The consequence of a war on essentially a civilian population.
It's incredible. I mean, when we think about that, and what gets me about it, I mean, you and I opposed the war. The Center for Constitutional Rights even wrote in a pamphlet called Against War with Iraq. It was written by me, Jenny Green, who was there, Barbara Olshansky, an anti-war primer. And it goes through all the reasons and all the BS, if people remember, about weapons of mass destruction.
Well, we all knew that was a canard. It was obvious that that was a falsehood to just rationalize the war. We all knew that. The government was propagating the lie that Iraq was about to attack us. Remember the famous mushroom cloud? But there were 20-some million people demonstrating around the world. We were in a demonstration in New York City, hundreds of thousands of people. We all knew that this was a lie.
The other piece of evidence that was a lie was, you know, we saw Colin Powell go before the United Nations holding vials of whatever he was holding, showing pictures of mobile uranium trucks or whatever they were. But one of the key pieces of evidence he used was the relationship between Al-Qaeda and Iraq and Saddam Hussein. And our listeners may not remember, but there was a man who was tortured by the CIA named Al-Libi. And as he was being tortured, he gave up information that there was a relationship between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, information
that was completely bogus. So let's think about this. This guy is tortured. He gives us the key link, a key link between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. That justifies to some people Bush's war, in addition to the so-called weapons of mass destruction. And so now you see the results of torture. No matter how many people you save in the future because you think you have to torture them, we've just killed 500,000 people because someone was tortured. So let's not talk about torture works. What torture work to do here was kill 500,000 people. Now, I want to talk about one of the things that's galled me throughout this and always galls me. We had just talked about Bill Keller on the program, the former executive editor of the Times, his blowhard stuff he writes on the op-ed page, the one he wrote about Manning recently. But you have to remember, Keller was at the Times when the Times pushed heavily and for the war and had people like Judith Miller, who basically said they have weapons of mass destruction, and they had much false reporting about the weapons of mass destruction on the front page of the Times. You know, I don't think there's a war that the Times has never not supported, but this one, they went out of their way, and they wrote a lot of stories about it. And in addition, Keller, who was at the Times at the time, wrote a piece after 9/11. As was said in an article, in the aftermath of 9/11, one that particularly fear-inducing, an 8,000-word New York Times magazine called Nuclear Nightmares, whose graphic description of what the detonation of a one-kiloton bomb in Times Square would do made New Yorkers and other people really fearful. And so he leads us into the war with these articles in the Times, with his own articles. And then when the war, right before the war, you get all of these liberal intellectuals, if you want to call them that. I would call them neocon liberal intellectuals or conservatives. And here's the list. And it's a list that, even though a number of, it's a list that people ought to remember, and I can add your own names to it. But what gets me, a lot of these people after the war made apologies, and we'll talk about that in a second. But here's some of the people, led by, of course, Bill Keller at the Times, Tom Friedman, who writes a column in the Times. Tom Friedman even suggested in one of his columns that the French who didn't support the war ought to be kicked off the Security Council of the UN. George Packer, supposed liberal writer for The New Yorker, supports the war. Jeffrey Goldberg, I think at The Atlantic now. Richard Cohn of The Washington Post. Blogger Andrew Sullivan, at the time a blogger, maybe still. Paul Berman of Dissent. And, of course, Christopher Hitchens. And Anne Marie Slaughter, who was at Princeton, leader of the International Law Society. All of these people, all of these liberals, paved our way to war. Now, a lot of them apologize afterwards, but their apologies were really weird because their apologies were not that they think they should have not had the war, but they think that because it was bungled afterwards, that the U.S. didn't do a good job of occupying Iraq, not that the U.S. didn't misunderstand the Iraqi people's, quote, welcome, but that they bungled it afterwards and therefore they shouldn't have supported the war. So in the apology that Keller gives, I could not foresee that we would mishandle the war so badly. And of course, the writer who wrote that, Greg Mitchell, who was a blogger at The Nation, writes that one of Keller's explanation, I could not foresee we would mishandle the war so badly, makes Keller look like a fool, Mitchell says, since so many others did predict that. His second line of defense, I could not have known how bad the intelligence one was, is equally damning. Note that Yusuf could not have known when a humble, honest man might have written, like we did, Michael, I should have known how bad the intelligence was. Then another writer writes, which goes along what we're saying, Keller's a revisionist historian, writes Middle East Matthew Taylor at Mondo Weiss, which was one of the best responses was given on Mondo Weiss, replying to Keller's assessments that the costs of occupying Iraq were greater than anyone anticipated. These guys are still writing, that they're still pundits, that they're still on TV, that they're still at the Times, is an outrage. These are the people the American people are listening to. Here's what Mondo Weiss Matthew Taylor writes. Speak for yourself, Keller, but millions worldwide anticipated that the cost would be enormous and were not fooled by weapons of mass destruction scaremongering. Nowhere in Keller's ramble does he mention the fact that Bush launched the invasion while inspectors were literally back in Iraq inspecting for WMDs, which I cannot see as anything but proof positive that this war had nothing to do with containing Iraq's WMD ability.
Michael, what did the late Tony Judge have to say about these liberals?
Well, he was really outraged by their support for imperialism, wars during Bush. And his best line in the long article he wrote, which is called Bush's Useful Idiots, Tony Judt on the Strange Death of Liberal America, is, quote, today America's liberal armchair warriors are the, quote, useful idiots of the war on terror. That's Tom Friedman. That's Bill Keller. That's the other people we've mentioned. We'll leave that with Tony, unfortunately, who's no longer with us. And just remember what Michael Smith said when we began this Iraq segment. Minimum, probably 500,000 civilians killed in a war that we were led into, in part, by the liberal media and these liberal pundits. Someday, somewhere, hopefully, there'll be justice for them as well.
Michael, you mentioned that the Manning case is receiving a lot more media attention, and Bill Keller of The Times had an op-ed piece recently.
I mean, the fact that that guy is still writing for The Times is outrageous. I mean, this guy is a blowhard.
Picked upstairs. He was the editor, and now he gets to write a column whenever he wants.
I mean, we're going to get to the point, because we're coming into the 10th anniversary of Iraq, of his support for the Iraq War, and then his mea culpa for that. That's not what I want to talk about right now, but that this guy has a column in the editorial page is like off the wall to me. But anyway, here's what he said. It's called Private Manning's Confidant. The article came out, I think, because at Bradley Manning's testimony, when he accepted responsibility, he said he tried to give the documents to the New York Times and the Washington Post. And he left a message for the New York Times, and the New York Times never called him back. So this is Bill Keller, former executive editor of The Times?
He was the editor.
Former editor of the New York Times trying to apologize, or not apologize, explain why the Times never called him back.
Cover their tracks.
Well, and one of the things he does, the first thing on that particular issue, he of course blames Bradley Manning. He says, how could it be that this guy who is a techie couldn't figure out how to get in touch with us better than by leaving a message on the answering machine of one of the public editor? Well, that's outrageous. I mean, he did leave the message. So there's more going on here. Some reason they never got back to him, or whatever reason, they didn't get back to Bradley Manning.
Well, certainly you could assume that the public editor told the person responsible that there was this message on his phone. That's what the public editor is supposed to do.
And so what our good friend Bill Keller says, it's puzzling to me that a skilled techie, of course he's 22 years old at the time, this skilled techie, couldn't get to us some other place. So he puts the blame on everybody else, which is typical of Keller, as we'll see in the Iraq situation. But then the article goes on to just dig a deeper hole for Bill Keller. So let's talk first about what he says about WikiLeaks. He first says about WikiLeaks that Julian Assange's hiding the Ecuador embassy. Well, he's hardly hiding. Everybody knows where he is. But he's afraid he might be extradited for his part in the hemorrhage of secrets, though the only allegations outstanding against him involve accusations of sex crimes in Sweden. Now, first of all, how does Bill Keller know that those are the only allegations outstanding against Julian Assange? There's been a grand jury sitting here for 2 years. The Stratfor emails said there was a sealed indictment against him, and the U.S. is not about to give guarantees of free passage to Julian Assange so he can go to Sweden and address the allegations in Sweden. If he had those, Julian Assange would be there in a second. So that's the first big error about Julian Assange. The second set of errors are about Bradley Manning. The first thing he says, this is back to the issue of we didn't get the documents, but WikiLeaks did. And he says it would have been different had we gotten the documents. And here's why. Well, some things would have been the same and some things would have been different. He says, what would we have done? He says, first of all, I can say with some confidence that the Times would have done exactly what it did with the archives when it was supplied to us via WikiLeaks. And of course, what he's really saying is we would have preferred to get these directly because he thinks they wouldn't be going down as hard on Bradley Manning if Manning had given them to a, quote, a legitimate newspaper like The Times versus WikiLeaks, which are hackers and, you know,
a more credible source.
Right. And aren't in love with the United States and have a political agenda, according to Keller. So he's saying we would have probably helped Bradley Manning out. He might not have been indicted for the most serious charges. Now, how does he know that, considering that he does cite Ellsberg, considering that Ellsberg gave it to the Times, but Ellsberg was indicted for espionage. So why would it have gone better for Bradley Manning? I'm not sure at all. But one thing we know would have gone worse, had Bradley Manning just given it to the New York Times guys, What do you think the New York Times would have done with some of the more sensitive documents?
Turn them over to the government.
Michael says buried them.
I say turn over to the government.
Or both. Or both. Or what actually, if you look at their history, what they do is they go to the White House and they say, what do you think?
Right.
Do you think it would be bad to expose this, quote, secret? So we know the history. In the case of the warrantless wiretapping,
a whole year. They sat on it for a year. And the only reason they released it was that James Risen was going to write a book about it.
Got it on the nose. So this is the Bill Keller saying that we would have been better off, or Bradley Manning would have been better off giving it to the Times, because the Times not only censors in its own way, but actually goes to the White House to decide. Is this what you call a newspaper, a muckraking newspaper? No, that's WikiLeaks. So the first thing that Keller does is try and, you know, say we're better than WikiLeaks. But in fact, of course, in terms of getting information out to the public, they're worse. The second thing he does, and this is terrible what he does on Manning, he basically makes the implication, if he actually says it, that he thinks the political explanations made by Bradley Manning are made after the fact, and really because of his supporters want to hear these political explanations. And here's how he gets there. He gets there with a falsehood. What he says about Bradley Manning is that before we heard from him the other day in court, quote, his political views come across as inchoate. When asked, he has trouble recalling any specific outrages that needed exposing. He gets to saying that Bradley Manning made up the facts, maybe, or made up his political motivation only in court because of the supporters, by first misquoting or misstating something that Bradley Manning said earlier. What Keller says is his, Manning's, political views come across as inchoate. When asked, he has trouble recalling any specific outrages that needed exposing. His cause was open diplomacy, or perhaps in jest, worldwide anarchy. But in fact, when Manning's alleged chat logs were revealed, the ones he had with Lamo, they gave a clear political motivation that's quoted everywhere. And Manning says in those chat logs, years ago, that he did this because what he saw, what the Iraqis were doing to people, how he was asked to investigate what happened to people who were criticizing the Iraq government, and he could no longer do that because of that. The political motivation is clear in the Lamo chat logs. Keller chooses to ignore it and instead reaches this incredible conclusion. Was Manning's sense of mission there from the start, or was it shaped afterward by expectations of the free Bradley Manning enthusiasts? Incredible conclusion, considering that to get there, Keller had a lie about what Manning said to Adrian Lamo. So this article, I mean, you know, what do you expect from Bill Keller, I guess? It's just really, really sad that this guy, Bill Keller, is allowed to have a third of a page in the op-ed of the New York Times. And it's terrible to imply that Manning's political motivation was made up after the fact, rather than one which is in black and white, printed in what purports to be the Lamo chat logs. So here's to Bradley Manning and what he did and the political motivation for his doing so.
Michael and Heidi, it was, of course, a great, great loss when Hugo Chavez died 2 weeks ago. Michael, you had written the Times a letter about that.
Well, you know, you can't quite get over the Times coverage of Chavez and the most media in the United States. Most, what you would call major media, just hated Chavez. I mean, they just went after him all the time. One of the best articles written about Chavez after his death is Greg Grandin's piece in The Nation.
Yeah.
It's really well done. Talks about the social movements that were created in Venezuela. Talks about what happened on the economic indicators to Venezuela compared to the poverty that was there before. Sure, there's poverty still today, but been cut in half or more. It was good to see The Nation's strong editorial. It was not good to see our major papers talk about it, and particularly the New York Times. Now, you may recall that there was a coup attempt. Actually, he was taken prisoner for a short while in 2002. I think it was April or so, 2002. And the Times, right after that coup, when he was still held prisoner, the Times wrote an editorial. I think it was April 13th, 2002. And it's something everybody ought to read because they supported the coup.
Yeah.
I mean, this is our wonderful newspaper has supported the coup. And what they said was they thought that because he was such a dictator undermining democratic institutions, essentially, that They supported the coup. Of course, they had mud on their face a week later when the coup was reversed. Chavez was back as a ruler. And the question is, would they have apologized had he not come back as a ruler? But in fact, he did. So then the Times writes an editorial apologizing in 2002, saying, well, we made a mistake. You know, we didn't know, but nobody knew anything about this in the United States. This was nothing the United States had planned or anything. But of course, evidence later revealed that at a minimum, the United States knew about the coup coming. So that's 2002. They endorse the coup of a democratically elected dictator. They claim the U.S. knows nothing about it. Of course, both are false. Then when he dies, what do they say? That Chavez's legacy is stained by the undermining of democratic institutions.
Which is ludicrous. Jimmy Carter, our former president, went over there and they supervised the elections in Venezuela. The most democratic elections in the world, according to our former president Carter.
And can I mention the National Lawyers Guild has said sent observers and found the same thing.
That's right. I thought that the coverage in the Times showed a real class hatred towards poor people.
Well, I think that's a good point, because if you look at this from the grassroots or from the base or the poor, Chavez was completely loved. He won every election by a lot, and he actually changed the circumstances for poor people.
Now, our colleagues in Cuba are obviously very disappointed and saddened by his death. What do you think the repercussions are going to be for that nation?
The Cubans got oil from Venezuela.
And Venezuela got doctors, 25,000.
Right, got doctors. Right. The new president, Nicolas Maduro, in Venezuela, will carry on the same policies that Chavez did. Not, I don't.
For 30 days, Michael, there's an election.
Yeah, and I think he's going to win the election.
I think he'll win also.
And I think actually, in terms of the stability of the kind of reforms that were going on in Venezuela, they're going to continue.
As much as we look at the Times as the paper of record, and a lot of us read it every day and get some information out of it, it's really a rag. I mean, you got to face it. And here's the letter I wrote, which they normally publish a lot of my letters. This one they didn't. This is very short. I wrote it the day after the editorial trashing Chavez appeared after his death. Today's editorial on Hugo Chavez is the very definition of chutzpah. It asserts that Chavez's, quote, legacy is stained by the undermining of democratic institutions, end quote. However, in April 2002, the Times endorsed a coup that temporarily forced out Chavez, a democratically elected leader. Just who is undermining democracy?
Yeah, really.
So there you go, everybody. Use your Times to wrap fish in.
Lynn Stewart is in a federal medical facility outside of Fort Worth, Texas. Had the original sentence of 28 months been allowed to stand and not appealed by the government, she'd be out by now. But instead, she's stuck doing a 10-year sentence, and she's had a reoccurrence of her breast cancer.
We're going to link on our website to a petition that is being circulated. It's a petition for compassionate release to free Lynn Stewart. I just want to read a couple of sentences from it. It says, as you mentioned, now, breast cancer, which had been in remission prior to her imprisonment, has reached stage 4. It has appeared in her lymph nodes, on her shoulder, in her bones, and her lungs. Her daughter, a physician, has sounded the alarm. Quote, under the best of circumstances, Lynn would be in a battle of the most serious consequences with dangerous odds. With cancer and cancer treatment, the complications can be as debilitating and as dangerous as the cancer itself. In her current setting, where trips to physicians involve attempting to walk with 10 pounds of shackles on her wrists and ankles, with connecting chains, Lynn Stewart has lacked ready access to physicians and specialists under conditions compatible with medical success.
She's 73 years old. When they put her in the hospital, they actually shackle her to the hospital bed. I want to read you just a paragraph from a letter that she wrote a couple weeks ago after chemo had started. She says, getting old ain't for sissies, nor is chemo. And she says, I've definitely been missing in action. My roommates and friends have been extraordinarily kind, helpful, bossy, sweet, and will make sure I come through this. The huge amount of mail I get is astounding to my fellow prisoners. I try to downplay it. Some poor souls never get a letter. But my usual answer to them is that the source of all this mail is my 73 years of trying to do some good works for people. When someone then said, and now you're here, I said that I've always been here, and the government didn't like it. I feel worst about the fact that I've run short of energy to help the women who already have spoken with me, but they all do understand.
Michael, I just want to read the end of the petition because I think it's worth noting that, quote, if Lynn's original sentence of 28 months had not been unreasonably punitively increased to 10 years, she would be home now, where her medical care would be by her choice and where those who love her best would care for her. Her isolation from this loving care would end. Prevent this cruelty to Lynn Stewart, whose lifelong commitment to justice is now a struggle for her life.
It's in the power of the Bureau of Prisons to grant her a compassionate release. It's been done before. If enough of us make enough noise, we'll get it done now. So help out. We're going to link to the petition on our website, lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.
Let's free Lynn. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. A 15-month investigation and documentary film by The Guardian and BBC Arabic has revealed how U.S. Colonel James Steele, a veteran of American proxy wars in El Salvador and Nicaragua, played a key role in training and overseeing U.S.-funded special police commandos who ran a network of torture centers in Iraq. Colonels Kaufman and Steele reported to Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and General David Petraeus. Petraeus, as listeners may know, was tasked with organizing Iraqi security services. We're joined by Patrick Farrelly to talk more about the documentary, The Search for Colonel James Steele. Patrick is a television, radio, and print journalist who has worked in the United States and Ireland. Welcome, Patrick, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
You've just done a film detailing how the United States is implicated in Iraqi police torture. What is it about?
Basically, this we have to go back to Iraq in 2004. The Bush administration, where it was becoming very, very clear to them that the projections that they had made about how they'd be welcomed in Iraq were just not true. The insurgency was growing at this extraordinary rate. More and more American soldiers were being killed, and it looked like as if the insurgency was at that point in the spring of 2004 just getting off the ground. So they really needed something. They needed a new strategy. They were stuck in a situation where, while they had a lot of troops on the ground, they really had very, very few people who actually spoke Arabic, and they had very, very few people who actually knew anything about the insurgency. So this is where they turned to, initially at least, actually, General David Petraeus. Because the one thing we got to remember about Petraeus, I know that in the press and in among the think tanks in Washington, he is seen as the scholar warrior. But in essence, David Petraeus' position in the U.S. military is as a guy who is a big, big advocate of counterinsurgency. It was at this point that Rumsfeld called upon him to go back into Iraq and to organize the training of a pretty massive police force in Iraq. And he went there, and straight away he saw the opportunities in terms of counterinsurgency, because he just saw this massive force that they could actually use to fight the insurgency. He hooked up with two people there. One was a guy, both Special Forces veterans, one was a guy called Colonel James Kaufman, and the other, more importantly, is a guy called Colonel James Steele. Steele's a fascinating character because He had been involved in the Vietnam War, where, of course, counterinsurgency had a major, major outing. Its reputation within the U.S. military at that stage was not very, very good in terms of the experience in Vietnam. He then emerges again in El Salvador in the 1980s as head of the MIL Group.
MIL Group is what?
Is a bunch of U.S. military advisors who essentially were training elements of what we might call the El Salvadorian security forces to fight the FMLN, to fight the guerrillas. I mean, we all know what happened there. Enormous amounts of people were killed by these people. Enormous amounts of people were tortured. But Colonel James Steele was the guy who was in charge of the American advisors who were training these people and also directing these forces. So while most people would have viewed what happened in El Salvador as a human rights disaster, within the annals of the American military, it was seen as a very, very successful counterinsurgency venture. There was also a very ambitious young young major who arrived there in the mid-80s, and his name was Major David Petraeus, who was invited there by a mentor of his.
This is into Salvador?
Into Salvador. He arrived there in 1986. According to one of our sources, he actually stayed with James Steele for about a week. He was brought there by General Jack Galvin, who was a general who was running what was happening in El Salvador out of Panama. So that connection was made back then. So we jump to 2004. The Bush administration needs a force on the ground.
The war is about a year old at
this
point.
The war is about a year old. They turn to Petraeus, and Petraeus brings in Steele, and he brings in Colonel James Kaufman, and they introduce him to this paramilitary force, special police commandos, that's very, very small at the time.
It's Iraqi.
Run by a guy who had been involved in a plot to overthrow Saddam. So we then end up with a situation where he introduces them to these guys. Petraeus is really impressed with these people. And that's when the spigot is turned on. Hundreds of millions of dollars flow into this new force, which hits the ground. And it is advised by Steele and by Kaufman. It is a rerun of Salvador. And they go from being a few hundred strong into being, you know, a force that grew to 17, 18,000 men, most of whom would be drawn from the Shia militias, like the Badr Brigades and the Mahdi Army, who were very, very anxious to get revenge on Sunnis. These people were basically put in uniform, armed and equipped by the U.S. government and essentially let loose.
A counterinsurgency force, right?
A classic counterinsurgency force.
And what did they do? I mean, tell us about what they do, because the headlines on these articles are U.S. implicated in Iraqi police torture. Petraeus knew about it. Rumsfeld knew about it. And it goes up the chain of command.
Well, with Colonel James Steele, who, as I said, the thing about Salvador and U.S. military, it's seen as a huge counterinsurgency success. So therefore, he was the guy on the ground. He's a sort of a legend in that area. So with him in charge, they put together this force. This force then sets up a whole chain of interrogation centers throughout northern Iraq, based in areas where you know, in mostly in Sunni areas. Because what the United States needs really badly is intelligence. They need to know who the insurgents are and where they can get them. And that Steele's expertise is having these guys on the ground. They go after the incident. They draw in thousands of people. They basically torture them for information. And it's Steele's job to collate that information so that they can then hand it over to the U.S. military. The U.S. military can then go after the insurgents, informed for the first time as to what they were dealing with. So for the United States, in 2004, 2005, and Petraeus admits this himself, they were the real cutting edge in terms of going after the insurgents. They were the first time the United States could actually make an impression on them, but thousands of people were tortured in the process.
Now, Steele and Kaufman were very close and were actually in the detention centers, right? So they couldn't say they didn't know what was going on.
Both of them were there. And the thing about it is, in terms of chain of command, you've got James Steele, who actually has no military standing whatsoever. He is a retired colonel. One of the reasons he's retired is because his career came askew in the late 80s when he was involved in the Iran-Contra affair and was found by a congressional committee to have lied.
It was the trading of what? Arms to Iraq?
To Iraq. It was
for money to support the Contras.
No, it was to Iran.
To Iran.
That's where they got the money from, and then they were able to buy weapons to give to the Contras because Congress had mandated that they couldn't do that, so which made it an illegal thing. So what you have is you have a situation where this guy is the master at putting together intelligence. He's the master at actually doing this stuff. So himself and Colonel Kaufman, as I say, sorry, he's retired. He's not part of the military administration. But Colonel James Kaufman is a U.S. Army colonel, and he reports directly to General Petraeus in the Army chain of command. Steele is a consultant or an advisor, but Kaufman actually is in the chain of command. So therefore, when this paramilitary force, when they need money, they need equipment or whatever, Kaufman's the guy who takes it upstairs to Petraeus, and Petraeus is the one who provides the money, provides the weapons, provides whatever. But so these guys were in these detention centers. You have this torture going on, and the torture is widespread. And this is where Bradley Manning comes in, because I know you guys have been talking about him. Part of the WikiLeaks discovery in terms of the war logs, which was released by Bradley Manning to WikiLeaks, shows this entire pattern of US soldiers coming across these detention centers, who are working with these detention centers because they're involved with these special police commandos. They're providing them with guys to interrogate. They're taking guys from them for further interrogation. And what they're seeing is consistently, they're giving reports of seeing torture, of seeing abuse. The Guardian came across went through these war logs, started looking at this stuff and started seeing this pattern of hundreds and hundreds of reports by US soldiers on the ground of this going on. And that's really what actually launched the inquiry. And that's what brought us to Colonel James Steele and Colonel James Kaufman and actually General David Petraeus.
It's interesting, Patrick, because these are what they call the Iraq war logs, which Bradley Manning talks about when he made his guilty plea the other day as to why he wanted to reveal them, because they were revealing all of this criminality, really, and the counterinsurgency, and which he didn't like. Now, can you give us a sense of two things? One is, why didn't any of this come out before? I mean, these war logs have been out for a couple of years now. And secondly, what kinds of torture is described?
I mean, the interesting thing for me about the war logs is that an enormous amount was made of WikiLeaks, an enormous amount was made of the stuff which The Times and The Guardian, El País and the other newspapers actually brought to light. But I have to say, from that point onwards, I think that the ball was dropped in many ways, in the sense of like journalists really getting into the detail of what these things revealed and actually following them up. And I think this documentary that The Guardian and BBC Arabic produced, I think, is an example of the kind of material which actually lies within these and which journalists really should be taking up. Going back to the question of these special police commandos, their existence is well known. General David Petraeus was interviewed, for example, there's a very fine frontline documentary called The Gangs of Iraq that Martin Smith made for PBS Frontline, in which he interviews General Petraeus. Petraeus is very proud of these. He's very proud of the commandos. But the way it was being posed in terms of our understanding of the situation was that after Petraeus left Iraq in September of 2005, he'd been there since June 2004 dealing with setting up this new police force. It is only really after that, according to them, that these abuses happened, when the Shia political parties really took over and when these Shia militias started getting integrated. In other words, it's one of these situations where the US Army and the US government sets up these police commandos, which the locals invariably corrupt at a certain point, and then, because they don't have the same standards as we do, start abusing people and torturing people. What this investigation has found is that from the very, very, very beginning, Colonel James Steele and Colonel James Kaufman, who answered to Petraeus and who answered to Rumsfeld, had, you know, worked with these guys in these detention centers and were witnesses to and knew that this stuff was going on. Because it's a production line. These young men come in, they're tortured.
How were they tortured?
Well, they were tortured by the worst kind of methods. I mean, these people were being hung up off ceilings. These people were having, like, you know, their nails pulled out with pliers. It was waterboarding. It was every conceivable wow. kind of torture that you can think of.
And how do we know that? That's in
was
the
it
document?
Documented?
It was because we had a very important individual spoke to the Guardian about the U.S. involvement for the first time. He's a man by the name of General Al-Samari Muntadhar. He had been a general in the... He was a Sunni. He'd been a general in Saddam's regime. And when the United States came in, he, actually, along with a number of others, took the United States at their word that, in fact, they were going to frame and bring about a, you know, a pretty regular democratic society. So they actually became involved with helping the United States initially put together this police force. So Muntadhar was there. He worked for the Minister of the Interior. He worked for police. He worked directly with Steele, and he worked with Kaufman. He had meetings with Petraeus.
How many people were tortured? 10, 100, 1,000?
We don't have exact numbers, but I think we're talking tens of thousands of people were actually brought in. You're dealing with, for example, if you take the ancient city of Samarra, a very, very, very important city in terms of the religion and the culture and the history of that area, which was also a place where there was enormous opposition to the occupation. They went in there, they turned the city library into a torture center. They turfed everything out that was there. In other words, all these books, all these manuscripts, and they turned it into a torture center. They would then go out at night. They were there for months on end in the fall and the winter of 2004. They would go out with trucks at night. They would pull in hundreds of people who were then being processed. This went on for months. So, I mean, the numbers in that place alone run into the thousands. And there was a network of approximately 14 of these centres that we're aware of throughout Iraq. So this was a large-scale operation, which produced a lot of results. I mean, that's one thing that I think we have to be sure of. This was a thing which terrorised the Sunni community. There was no two ways. It was incredibly effective in terms of scaring the living daylights out of people, because this force that they put on the ground and which started to work was a feared force. If they arrived in your neighborhood in their Dodge trucks, because there's one thing these guys were very, very happy about, Petraeus gave them 150 Dodge trucks. They were then provided with other American pickup trucks. And now I know in this country it's a great thing to see if you're out there in the farmlands, but if you were living in a Sunni neighborhood and you saw one of these trucks arriving, this was not a good thing.
Well, the result was a mass intimidation.
It was a mass intimidation, but it was also the case that they tortured people into giving up. You know, one of the American soldiers that we interviewed for this said, you know, people just gave up everybody. They just gave up their relatives, their friends. It just became this interrogation and torture mill, which no doubt produced a lot of information. These things do.
You know, individuals, when you do a few, it's not so clear. People will do anything to stop torture. They'll give false names. They'll do all kinds of things. But like in Algeria in 1954, the French did mass torturing in Algiers. And as a result, they could cross the people enough so that they knew which information was accurate or not. They had thousands of people tortured, and that's what this sounds like.
And they did it also in Vietnam around the same time. Green Berets were involved in Vietnam. And in fact, it were Green Berets, Michael and I did a book, who were brought into Bolivia to train the Bolivian troops, and they eventually captured Che Guevara. So this streak in American history of Green Berets, Special Forces, torture, goes all the way back over half a century.
I mean, for want of a better term, for empire, people like James Steele are very, very important.
Explain that a little bit.
You know,
bit.
In the sense that if you go, you know, empires tend to roam into other people's countries and, you know, it's like living next door to a warlord. They're never good neighbors. But when they go in and they run into local opposition, and quite often it's you know, what they call asymmetrical warfare. It's guerrilla warfare. It's a so-called irregular uprising. Guys like James Steele are needed in order to deal with people like that. And that was his specialty. There is another long-term consequence I just want to deal with for a moment in terms of Iraq, which is that as this force became more and more part of the Shia militias. It became full. I mean, at a certain point, this force was 90% members of the Badr Brigades, 90% Mehdi Army, who went into Sunni neighborhoods and caused great, great slaughter. It also resulted in, because this force and because the Iraqi police force in general became such a sectarian instrument against the Sunnis, it forced an alliance between the Sunnis and al-Qaeda because of the pressure on the Sunni community. They thought, well, these are people who at least will come back and will use the kind of horrible methods that they do. And so you ended up with a situation where it actually brought about or played a very important role in bringing about an alliance between al-Qaeda and the Sunnis, which meant that in 2006, certainly, this became a fully-fledged civil war where at one point there was like 3,000 bodies showing up on the street every month. And it's an interesting in a way because it resulted in this terrible, horrible crisis where an awful lot of Americans were being killed, much, much more Iraqis were being killed. But what did this result in? It resulted in a situation where General David Petraeus was sent back into Iraq to lead the surge in 2007 to deal with what? A sectarian civil war.
What are Steele and Kaufman doing now?
Kaufman is still a serving member of the U.S. military. James Steele is retired. He was retired when he was in Iraq, but he wasn't really retired. He lives in Texas. He's involved in the energy business. At one point, he was actually a vice president of Enron. He's also on the lecture circuit. He's registered with a motivational speakers bureau where he talks about his experience in post-conflict resolution and also in counterinsurgency.
How much traction has this story had? I mean, you know, you revealed thousands of tortures. It's based in part on, of course, the Iraq war logs from Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks. You've nailed Steele and Kaufman, Petraeus, maybe Rumsfeld, which you haven't mentioned yet, up the chain of command. What was the reaction to the Guardian article? Do you see any congressional investigations coming? Any?
Well, it got a lot of traction in Europe, and it also a lot of traction in the blogosphere here, particularly the progressive blogosphere. But let me tell you, it had an interesting reaction. It was broadcast. This was broadcast in Iraq last Wednesday night, right? In the city of Samarra, the documentary, the BBC Arabic broadcast, was projected on a big screen in one of the main city squares. Thousands of people showed up, including people who had been tortured in the city library. And it was an extraordinary event. And afterwards, I think some of the people were brought up and actually spoke. And it was a hugely enthusiastic response. So in the Arab world, this has really been a very, very, very big documentary. It's got a lot of attention in Europe. Here in the United States, it has basically been completely ignored by the mainstream media. I mean, I do think that the connection between certainly General Petraeus, who has been in the news because of his affair, I think this is probably a more interesting story in terms of what his actual career was. I don't know. Maybe it will be taken up. Maybe it won't. But certainly I know that in the Arab world, it was very, very important. And I think for The Guardian, it was very, very important in the sense it ran on The Guardian website. They were amazed by the number of hits they had. This documentary is still running on The Guardian website. It's about 51 minutes long. You can go there, you can see it. And a lot of people, the thing that amazed The Guardian was that the amount of people who actually were watching it from beginning to end on their website. You go to The Guardian website and just, you know, put in James Steele in a search, you'll find it. But I just want to say this documentary was made by an entire crew of people going back. This is an investigation that went on for 15 months. It was produced by Maggie O'Kane, who is a very, you know, important journalist, head of, you know, multimedia investigations, and a whole crew of other people like Teresa Smith and Mona Mahmoud. And it was like approximately a dozen people involved in this. So it was very much a major team effort.
What does the Obama doctrine of we have to look forward, not backward, have to say about whether justice will be ever done here?
Well, I mean, I don't know whether you guys saw the interview that Dick Cheney did with Charlie Rose there a couple of weeks ago, in which he said that the people who'd been involved in the war in Iraq and who'd prosecuted and so on were very, very worried and caused a lot of anxiety for the first few months of the Obama administration. Until, of course, Obama said that, you know, people didn't have anything to worry about because they didn't want to dwell on the past. We'd been through a dark time. It's time to look to the future, which basically means that people like James Steele will never have to answer. But people like James Steele, as I'm sure you people know, never have had to answer. I mean, in all of the wars that go back, when have these people ever been called to account? And I think it's pretty much guaranteed on the Obama administration that they never will be. But I mean, some of the problem, I think, with this is that the public really isn't aware of what is being done in the name of U.S. taxpayers in foreign lands. And I think if they did know more, perhaps that situation might change.
You took us back to 2004 or so when these torture centers were set up. I'm trying to figure out and recall the Shias, the Sunnis. Saddam Hussein was a
Sunni.
Sunni, so that when he was overthrown, the Shias.
I mean, the thing about Iraq is that Saddam Hussein's regime drew most of its support from the Sunni population, who are 20% of the population of Iraq. Another 60% of the population of Iraq, the Shia community, were basically locked out of Saddam's regime. And indeed, I mean, it's been estimated that he may have been responsible for killing maybe numbers range to over 100,000 Shia during the time when he was in power. That's not to say that if you're a Sunni, you got an easy time. But he drew his support from the Sunni community. And therefore, once he was overthrown, that 60% Shia community, you know, an awful lot of them were wanted their revenge on people they saw as being part of Saddam's regime, and they came to see the insurgency as being part of that, wrongly or not.
The torture that took place was basically, it's not always a religious explanation, but was Shia against Shia torturing Sunnis, is that right?
It was Shia torturing Sunnis, except that, of course, it is the nature of counterinsurgency that, you know, they were funded to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars by the Bush administration. They were put in uniforms and armed and equipped by the Bush administration. And their activities were overseen by the Bush administration, who needed the information that came from these interrogations in order to further their war against the insurgency. And also it had, as I say, the effect of terrifying the Sunni community and demoralizing those people who were opposed to the U.S. and coalition occupation.
That's very important. Well, thank you for that.
Patrick, to sum it up, how would you describe the situation in Iraq now as opposed to the way it was 10 years ago before the American aggression?
I mean, I think it's very, very clear that the Sunni community particularly is completely disenfranchised. I think it's still in a state of terror. I think you've got this very, very autocratic Shia regime, which by most accounts is very, very corrupt, and which I think in many, many ways is a mirror image of the situation under Saddam Hussein.
Patrick, this is a fabulous service that you've provided by making this film, and we thank you so much.
Remarkable. I mean, it's amazing how few people in America know about it. I mean,
Patrick Farrelly, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
What's next, Patrick?
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.